Has feeding people in South Florida become political? Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Two nonprofits in South Florida, both focused on food insecurity, are battling for federal dollars. FarmShare and Homestead won the contract by a narrow margin, and now they're responsible for most of South Florida. But there's a push to overturn the decision, and it's made its way to Congress.
We have tens of thousands of families who rely on making sure that they have access to this food.
Also, why are canine units, police dogs, being used more often on black men in Broward? We're going to look at a new Sun Sentinel investigation examining the data. And finally, this Saturday marks 5 years since the Pulse massacre in Orlando. We'll learn about the work still being done to help the survivors. All of that today on Sundial after the news. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thank you so much for joining us today. There's a fight over who will feed tens of thousands of the food insecure. Feeding South Florida, based in Pembroke Park, has been responsible for feeding families in need in Broward and Palm Beach counties. FarmShare, based in Homestead, handles food distribution in Miami-Dade. But the state recently awarded a new contract, and FarmShare will now be responsible for all three counties. Independent reviewers with the state's department were responsible for scoring both organizations, and they won the contract by a narrow margin. But there's been an outcry from Broward County commissioners to Democratic Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz. They argue Feeding South Florida is the only group capable of handling the job. We spoke with Congresswoman Wasserman Schultz yesterday. We should note, Feeding South Florida is a community partner of WLRN, but has no impact on our editorial decisions. Congresswoman Wasserman Schultz, how significant is the state's emergency food assistance program in serving families in need throughout the state of Florida?
This is a contract that makes sure that it literally tens of thousands, if not many more than that, of families who are food insecure are able to have their nutritional needs met on a regular and consistent basis. And, you know, that is something that Feeding South Florida has been able to do for many years and then exponentially stepped up the volume that they were able to distribute, the needs that they were able to be met, that they were able to meet during the pandemic. And now, with this shift in the contract that came out of the TPAC decision from the Department of Agriculture, I'm very concerned that these food insecure families are going to really be in some jeopardy, and that instead of being able to make sure we can keep them well fed with nutritious food, that we're going to have a contract that is going to have gaps and spots and inconsistencies that didn't exist before.
And talking about that with the contract, independent reviewers from the state's Department of Agriculture scored both FarmShare and Feeding South Florida's abilities to distribute food. FarmShare scored higher, and thus they're going to be awarded the contract for Palm Beach and Broward counties. Why do you believe the independent review was wrong and Feeding South Florida should maintain that contract?
I mean, even after looking at the score sheets that were reviewed, if the Department of Agriculture maintains a thorough review process was already conducted, then it should be obvious that Feeding South Florida would have come out on top. The scoring that was done showed that both agencies scored very closely, and there were clear mathematical errors that appear to have been made, inconsistencies in the information that was able to be accessed by the reviewers from the State Department of Agriculture. And so I'm encouraged to hear that Commissioner Freed, the Department of Agriculture commissioner, personally committed to reviewing and, you know, accurately rescoring the applications. I'm really now concerned, because that's what we've been pushing for, is for a re-review. There's now concern because there was a statement put out by the commissioner's spokesperson that really was in direct conflict with the commissioner's statement. What her spokesperson said was a full-throated defense of how the contract was evaluated. And they met with Feeding South Florida, they listened to their concerns, and the staff reviewed the scoring, and that it was revalidated. So really what absolutely is essential here is, because it's understandable with a review by the commissioner, that if her staff has dug in on that, it would be surprising if she gave more than a cursory review and actually objectively went ahead and identified whether there were scoring errors made. So they need a third party review here.
And you spoke with Feeding South Florida CEO Paco Velez about the concerns of this new contract, but did you talk to the representatives from FarmShare about their capacity to distribute food in Broward and Palm Beach County?
I mean, it has been very clear that there are gaps in the FarmShare's capacity. They don't have the trucking necessary. They don't have the warehousing available. They have been publicly stating that those are things that they would actually have to lease. And, you know, for example, it appears that their trucking is not 18-wheeler tractor trailers like Feeding South Florida has that can easily, readily transport, you know, millions of pounds of food across our community here in South Florida. Feeding South Florida's trucks are here. The access to vehicles that FarmShare appears to have are distributed around the state. Some of them are vans, some of them are flatbeds, and they seem to be saying that they would need to lease and that they could get access to trucks and move them around. That just shows me that there has to have been mistakes made in the scoring. And frankly, you need what needs to be set up is a objective creation of a clear rubric that assigns standardized point values. You need to make sure that there is an objective review of all of that. And what's really disturbing to me, because these are federal funds, is why isn't there an appeals process? I don't know of any federal contract that doesn't have an appeals process where if there's a potential problem that it can be contested, it can be appealed, and the decision can ultimately be reviewed and reversed objectively. And I don't understand why that process doesn't exist in the State Department of Agriculture.
You talk about funding. I mean, Feeding South Florida almost ran out of money in December, with COVID pushing higher demand on the services. They depended on CARES Act money. Are you confident they'll be able to remain financially solvent this fall when the federal funds may not be so readily available?
Oh, I'm quite confident because they were actually handling this contract before pre-COVID. You know, this isn't a COVID-based contract. This is the regular contract to decide which agency is going to be responsible for providing the nutritional needs to the food insecure in Broward and Miami-Dade County, in Broward, Palm Beach, and Miami-Dade counties. And Feeding South Florida was really doing that extremely well, and then stepped up during COVID. All agencies were over, you know, were taxed significantly during COVID. So there appears to be some inconsistencies here that resulted in the awarding of a contract to an agency that, unfortunately, I don't think is even beginning to be prepared to handle this contract.
And you mentioned a moment ago, you mentioned the news, Agriculture Commissioner Nikki Fried announcing through a spokesperson that she plans to review the scoring process next week when she's in Tallahassee. This comes following intense public pressure. Velez even testifying at the Broward County Commission. Why shouldn't voters see this move as politically motivated rather than awarding a contract based on merit?
Well, that's the problem, is that the contract doesn't appear to have been awarded on merit and that there are mathematical errors that have been made. If you look at the very close numbers, I mean, they have differences of, you know, less than a point in some cases. And so an objective review is absolutely essential, because the only thing that matters is making sure that we have the agency managing this contract that can absolutely handle distributing the food necessary to keep people who are food insecure healthy and well fed. And so if there is something that has been decided, if a contract has been decided wrongly and there are errors made, that's in jeopardy. And so that's the only thing I'm standing up for. I'm not sure what politics would be involved here. You know, I'm a member of Congress. I sit on the Agriculture Appropriations Subcommittee, And we're responsible for making sure that the funding that is distributed from the TPAC program is spent wisely and that there's accountability. And so that's what I'm engaging in.
That was Democratic Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz. We'll get back to our discussion with her in a minute. But first, we wanted to bring in Steve Shelley. He's the CEO of FarmShare and Homestead, and he's also Homestead's mayor. We asked him to respond to some of the comments made just now by the congresswoman. We spoke earlier this morning.
Well, first I want to state, you know, from experience, I know it's tough being an elected official. You try to get involved in your community. You try to understand the issues that are going on. But ultimately, you're only as good as the information that you're provided. In this particular case, I don't think the congressman has all the information. Unfortunately, FarmShare has not had an opportunity to talk with her, and maybe that's on FarmShare's fault for not being able to reach out to her sooner to get her that information. But ultimately, FarmShare has the warehousing space. We have the ability. We have all the resources necessary to serve Broward. Within 56 miles of Broward County, I have over 70,000 square feet of warehousing space. In Broward County alone, as it is now, I have 13,000 square foot with a lease right now to acquire an additional 28,000 square foot of warehouse space. So ultimately, 41,000 square foot of warehouse space in Broward County alone and 70,000 square foot of warehouse space within 56 miles of Broward County Center.
And she also talked about the trucks. Do you have the trucks? Do you have the ability to move that food?
We do have the trucks. So we have a fleet of semi-trucks and refrigerated box trucks. I've got 10 semi-trucks in my system. I've got 19 refrigerated 26-foot box trucks in my system as well. I've got an additional 15 refrigerated semi-trailers that'll pair up with those 10 semi-trucks. And then I always have the ability to rent additional tractors to pull the five trailers that I don't have a matching semi for. We did that during the pandemic when we needed additional volume of food moved. You rent a semi truck, you hook it up to the trailer that I already have. It's a refrigerated trailer, and off I'm able to go. So essentially, I have the ability to have 15 semi trucks fully outfitted and ready to deliver food in Broward County.
Agriculture Commissioner Nikki Fried said is set to review the scoring for the Emergency Food Assistance Program contracts. What happens if the scoring is changed and then you lose those counties? Can you appeal?
You know, and I think that's the fuzzy thing here, that nobody really knows, you know, what that outcome would look like. I mean, ultimately, it would be very arbitrary to, at this point, after this process is run through its course, after we've essentially gone through what would be litigation, had hearings in front of a judge. You know, I can't imagine that her staff hasn't reviewed these scores two, three, four, five times along the way, along this process, to verify that they were, in fact, accurate, correct, arrived at through a, you know, five panel expert and knowledgeable staff members that reviewed this. So I think it'd be very difficult at this point. I'd be very surprised if those scores would be changed or that they would find anything that they haven't found already through this whole process.
You know, I mean, you touched on everything that you have and all the space that you have and the equipment, but you're talking to the listeners. You know, explain to them why they should be confident that your organization has the ability to expand its operations into the second and third largest counties in the state by population.
So FarmShare has been around for 30 years. We've been administering the TFAT program for 25 of those 30 years. We've been doing it well. We have a great reputation. Every community that we serve has been very excited about us being there. We've been able to serve the poorest of the poor, the people who are most reliant on food products. We have a history of serving large metropolitan areas, whether it be Miami-Dade County, whether it be Duval County, and places in between. And from a statistical standpoint, right now, FarmShare administers about 23% of the statewide TFAP contract.
And you kept mentioning TFAP just to make sure people understand that's the Emergency Food Assistance Program.
That is correct. Yes, the Emergency Food Assistance Program. Feeding South Florida only administers 17.6% of the statewide contract. So any allegations or any claims that FarmShare doesn't have the capability or that Feeding South Florida is the only organization that's capable, I think the statistics themselves play that out, that we're already administering more of the TFAP program than the current provider is. And Miami-Dade County alone is nearly 13% of the contract. The new contract for Broward is only 9.87%. So again, FarmShare already has proof, history, statistically, that we are able to and already serving counties that are equivalent of what Broward County would be.
That was FarmShare CEO Steve Shelley. You could read more about the controversy surrounding this new contract. Just go to our social media at WLRN Sundial. I want to get back to the conversation that we were having with Democratic Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz, and now looking specifically at new coronavirus funding being discussed right now in the House. I know there are discussions in the House about a new round of stimulus checks. Are you aware of any talks around further financial support focused specifically on housing?
You know, we put money in the pockets of working families and made sure that shots are in arms so we can safely begin to reopen our schools and economy. And that's been happening. And, you know, unfortunately, we've had to go it alone to get us in this better place. Republicans turned their back on South Florida when we needed them to step up. And housing in particular is really an important issue. We were able to distribute millions of dollars to help people be able to get rental assistance, for example. You know, nearly $200 million in rental assistance is going to keep a roof over the head of struggling families in South Florida. And you know, I know that that's been going smoothly in Miami-Dade County and Palm Beach County, less smoothly in Broward County, and I've been asking questions about that. And I know that they are in the midst of trying to make sure they can ramp up as quickly as possible to get those funds distributed.
Yeah, and you talk about the issues in Broward County. Through the CARES Act, Broward County secures $25 million in rental assistance, yet the Sun Sentinel found that of the more than 5,000 individuals that have initiated the process, only 70 have received support from the county. So what, I mean, from Congress, what can you do to ensure that those funds are allocated?
There, we have a weekly call with Broward County, all of the legislators that represent Broward County, all the way through COVID. And I had an opportunity to ask the county questions about where they are in the process last week. And I'm confident that they're moving forward to try to expeditiously get those funds.
But can you hold them accountable in any way? Or once they have the money, that's up to them?
Asking them questions and making sure that I can stay on, that I'm staying on top of their distribution is how I'm able to hold them accountable.
Given the president's inability to receive bipartisan support for his infrastructure plan, are you confident that this sharply divided Congress will be able to secure funding for another COVID relief package?
You know, it's absolutely essential that we work together to make sure that we can pass the American Jobs Act, pass the American Families Plan. We have child care and elder care that are vital in Florida. The fact that our own Republican senators are unwilling to compromise on this shows how extreme the other side of the aisle has become. But if we have to go it alone and fight for our seniors and children, then Democrats are willing to do that. President Biden has bent over backwards to find room to compromise. At some point, bipartisanship needs to make way for results. And people in South Florida need results, and that's what I'm going to be fighting for.
I want to finish with this, Congresswoman. You know, speaking of that division in Congress, your former colleague Alcee Hastings' seat remains unfilled, and under the governor's plan, that'll remain unfilled until at least January of next year. What pressure are you and your colleagues placing to try to get this special election up sooner, or can you?
Unfortunately, the pressure that we did apply on Governor DeSantis fell, like mostly everything else, on deaf ears. He ignored all of the entreaties and actually the precedent that existed with other special elections for Congress, and decided that it was perfectly okay to leave Congressman Hastings' constituents unrepresented for the rest of the year. What that meant was that they weren't able to have community projects filed through the appropriations process, and so resources will be missed and not brought home for folks in his district. It meant that none of the young people who wanted to attend a military academy in his district were able to seek a nomination from their member of Congress, because Governor DeSantis left that seat open for the rest of the year. Why? Because it benefits his party to make it harder for President Biden to pass his agenda, because we have such a small majority in the House of Representatives.
Is there a timeline, Congresswoman, for another round of stimulus checks? Are there plans for negotiations in the coming weeks?
What we need to do is we need long-term funding that would result from our passing the American Jobs Act and the Americans Family Plan. And so that's the next step here, is that we need to make sure that whether it's making the child tax credit permanent so that families can get that assistance throughout the year from the child tax credit and be able to make sure that we can permanently pull, you know, children who are living in poverty out of poverty permanently, making sure that there are resources available so that we can make investments in our infrastructure so we can create good jobs.
But there's no timeline though, right now.
the timeline is immediate. We are, the president, as folks have seen, has been attempting to negotiate with Republicans who seem to not be able to take yes for an answer. He's proposed himself, you know, multiple compromises, and those have been rejected only to have Republicans propose not much more than is already being spent on, that would already be spent on investing in infrastructure. That makes no sense. That's not stimulus. And we need to make sure that we have real investments of federal resources that will create, you know, thousands and thousands of jobs in our state, millions of jobs across the country. And we need to do that with Republican cooperation. But if they won't, then we'll go it alone.
That was Democratic Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz. Find more coverage of COVID-19 by heading to WLRN.org/coronavirus. You can also sign up for our weekly coronavirus newsletter. Well, still to come, a new investigation explores why canine units in Broward County are being sent after black men, sometimes for petty crimes. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. A new Sun Sentinel investigation looked into how Broward law enforcement is using canine dogs in arrests. They found that over the past 17 months, 84% of the people bitten were black. Racial disparities in the criminal justice system are too common, but this overwhelming majority far exceeds both the percentage of black residents living in the area and the percentage of black arrests. They also discovered a significant amount of the arrests were for petty crimes. Sun Sentinel reporters Brittany Wallman and Mario Riza worked on the investigation, and they join us now. Brittany, Mario, thank you so much. Brittany, I wanted to start with you. How did you find this story? What brought you to it?
Well, after the death of George Floyd and all of the, you know, this is a national story, the use of force, police brutality, and our black citizens. And we were hearing here locally concerns, particularly from the public defender's office, who represents many of these people, that dog use needed to be looked at a little bit closer. So that's what we did.
Mario, you spoke with some of the people who were on the receiving end of these canine attacks, these bites. How open were they to talking about it, and what were some of the common threads that you kept hearing?
Sure. So in some instances, you know, we spoke to people who had been bitten and, you know, didn't have that much in terms of the crime that they were charged with. We spoke with other people who were still in jail for that particular crime that they were bitten over. But all in all, everybody was pretty open to talking about the dog bite when we could reach them. Some people were very difficult to reach because, you know, often we found that the dogs bite people who aren't necessarily the most plugged into society, folks who are indigent. We noticed that everybody reported that they still had some amount of discomfort and pain around the area of the dog bite. I mean, uniformly, they were all like, hey, this still hurts. I can't move the arm or I can't feel the area in my leg where the dog bit. You know, one guy told us he still sees the dog in his dreams chasing him.
You know, I was going to ask you, Mario, were there any stories that really jumped out at you?
Oh yeah. I mean, the one that we led the story with of Pavon Davis, was really quite shocking. You know, Pavon is no previous criminal record. He and a bunch of his friends had hopped over the fence to go into Flanagan High School to play a game of manhunt. And they end up becoming the hunted that evening. You know, and a Pembroke Pines, police officer ends up, finding Pavon in the bushes with his dog, and the dog clamps on to Pavon's leg. And, you know, we spoke to Pavon, and it was a tale. He really never expected to, you know, that night to end up with him getting bitten by the dog.
And one of the things that you point out is that it's not just the fact they have these scars and these memories. There's a financial impact too, in some cases.
Yeah, for the folks who were no longer incarcerated that we were speaking to, we found that they were actually stuck with the bill for the dog bite. So they were paying the medical bills for this.
Brittany, looking at these statistics that you find, 84% of the people bitten were Black. How does that compare to the actual Black population and the number of Black arrestees?
The bite statistic is just much higher than we expected. We did expect to see that most of the bite victims would probably be Black, because while Black people are about a third of the population in Broward, they're about half or more in some of these cities of arrestees, you know, for a variety of reasons. But when you look at the bite stat, you know, 84% of them, it's out of whack.
And the other thing, too, is you found a big portion of these were kids.
Yeah, that is something that we did not expect, because it's officially frowned upon. The policies gear towards, only in the most dire situations should a child, a juvenile, a minor be bit, or, you know, or a mentally ill person be attacked and bitten by the dog. And we found that about 1 in 5 were children, especially in Hollywood. Hollywood bit it was surprising. Almost half of their bites were of juveniles. And,
Brittany, I want to know, what's the policy, in when they use canines? I mean, do they have an actual, like in the book, say, this is when you bring out the dog?
Yeah. I mean, in general, and each agency was slightly different, but in general, you're not going to use it on somebody that committed a misdemeanor. And if it's a child, a juvenile, and you know that it's a juvenile, then, it's got to be some kind of violent felony. But what ends up happening is, there are a whole lot of felonies that, if somebody, like one of the guys, he wasn't a minor, but stole a bike off of a carport. Well, that could be a misdemeanor. And if it's a cheap bike, he grabs it off, but you could also say it's a felony because, it was an expensive bike and the person was home. And so it's a lot of judgment call like that, where I think the typical person in public would say, and we're hearing a lot from people saying, if you committed a crime, that's what the dogs are for. But we just found an awful lot of cases of, what's, I think most people would consider a petty crime or no crime at all, or, jiggling the door of a locked car and, or just running.
Yeah. Mario, what were some of the typical crimes, according to the statistics you found? What were the typical crimes or cases associated with the bites?
So we found 94 bites over the 17-month period that we examined. More than 50 of them were associated with either stealing a car or stealing something from a car, which, indicates that this is a tactic used to really police what we call property crimes. Now, we should also note, the police typically only use dogs or are only supposed to use dogs on people who run, right? So this is when somebody's driving a vehicle that perhaps they shouldn't, and the police flip on their lights and they ditch the vehicle and they go off running. That's when the dog gets called in.
Mario, some police departments in the country are retiring their dogs or training them just to bark and not bite. Where are we seeing this? And do we know yet what impact those changes have had? Are the dogs still useful?
Sure. So in Salt Lake City, there was a bit of a scandal where a canine officer had his dog bite somebody who was handcuffed. And that led to an investigation, and it led to, if I remember correctly, the dissolution of that city's canine department. In New Orleans, the Department of Justice actually stepped in and said, hey, your dog unit isn't necessarily being run in the best way. Let's reform it. And after the reform, it's been very uncommon for dogs in New Orleans to bite anybody. The former Attorney General of California, who's now the Health and Human Secretary, I think his last name is Becerra, he's called for a shift in strategies and tactics for using the dogs, from this find and bite approach that we saw very prevalent here in Broward County to what's called a find and bark approach, where the dog finds somebody in the dark in the woods,
right.
But instead of, you know, clamping down on them, they just let the officer know.
Yeah, and it is Javier Becerra. Yes. Talking with Sun Sentinel investigative reporters Brittany Wallman and Mario Riza, we're talking about their new investigation piece that explores how law enforcement in Broward County are using canine dogs in arrest. And data shows the majority of people bitten by these police dogs are Black, and they were arrested in many cases for petty crimes. And you can find their full investigation on our social media. Check it out. It's at WLRN Sundial. Brittany, okay, so this comes out. You have this information, the statistics. What's the response from law enforcement leaders?
Well, it's been very defensive. I think partly because law enforcement feels under attack, if you will, nationally because of this whole reckoning that's going on. There wasn't anyone in law enforcement that told us, you know, you're right. That is concerning. I hadn't looked at that or anything like that. And this is larger than us. These are societal and cultural issues. And, you know, it's not us. We're just doing what we're allowed to do, that kind of thing.
And how about the activists? How about any advocacy groups? What have they said, or have they responded yet?
Well, I mean, what we're hearing a lot, is that friction that exists, on this discussion in all types of use of force and police use of force against Black people. Activists, and statistics have shown that over policing in Black communities is a real thing, and. So it's just something that, it's just part of, I don't know that there's going to be an easy solution because it's agency by agency. But I think this is just part of sort of airing and unearthing some, with facts, some things that should be considered concerning.
Mario, in the investigation, law enforcement officers point to scenarios where it's not safe for them to follow a suspect, like into some dark overgrown lot or something. Is there an argument, though, for canine bites that they have no other option? Did you find in any of the statistics?
Yeah, I mean, listen, there are moments when the use of the dog and the dog's jaws seem rational and reasonable to anybody who would look at the case, right? There are moments when, only the canine can go in and extract somebody who's holed up with a gun or something like that, or whether or not you don't know if they have a gun. But the thing is that's the justification for the existence of the dog unit in a lot of the instances. Hey, our canine partners are going to go in when we can't, and they're going to save us, or they're going to find people that we can't find. But what we discovered when we started looking at the charges against the people who had been bitten was that this wasn't necessarily the case for the vast majority of the dog bites, right? That was maybe a third of the time it was a dangerous, violent criminal or suspected dangerous, violent criminal. The rest of the time it was a property crime.
And, just to mention, too, by the way, I mean, you spoke with one Broward Sheriff's Office detective who spoke up about what they thought was a bad bite, how they described that. What did they say? What happened?
Yeah. So this is an older case back in 2013. BSO Detective Jeffrey Kogan kind of mentioned to a prosecutor at one point that he'd seen a Fort Lauderdale officer unnecessarily use his dog against a suspect who had perhaps already been detained. Prosecutors investigated, they cleared the officer from the Fort Lauderdale Police Department, but then Kogan ended up getting transferred over to another department, which he claimed was, retaliation for disclosing this. He sued and the agency settled for almost $400,000.
This is a fascinating investigation. The numbers are right there in front of you. You want to check this out, go to our social media, WLRN Sundial, a new Sun Sentinel investigation into the use of canines, canine units, and how many people they're biting, and a majority of them are Black. Sun Sentinel investigative reporters Brittany Wallman and Mario Riza, thank you so much for the time. I appreciate it.
Thank you for reading.
Yes. Yeah, again, check out that investigation again on our social media, WLRN Sundial. Well, still to come, this Saturday marks 5 years since the Pulse nightclub massacre. How are the victims and their families recovering? Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. This Saturday is a difficult one for queer communities and their allies across Florida. It marks 5 years since 49 lives were taken in the Pulse nightclub shooting in Orlando, one of the largest mass shootings in our nation's history. Joel Jr. Morales knows the pain and resilience of the survivors and the victims' families all too well. He's the director of operations for the LGBTQ Center in Orlando. And he's been working with these communities over the last 5 years to ensure that they receive the services that they need. Joel, thank you so much for being with us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
And to note, there will be a series of memorials taking place across Florida, as well as local fundraising events. We've included more information on our social media at WLRN Sundial, if in case you're interested in knowing about some of them. Joel, you and Orlando's LGBTQ Center were on the ground responding immediately after the shooting 5 years ago. You were in the hospital talking directly with the survivors, coordinating with family. Help us understand where the greatest needs were at the time.
Yeah, let me tell you, like, just reflecting back, we're approaching the 5-year mark right now this Saturday. And for us in our community, it feels like it's yesterday. And I know for a lot of people who have felt the impact of this tragedy worldwide, it feels like it's yesterday, especially for communities of color and the queer community. Early on in the days of the tragedy, as a person that's been working in this community for a very long time, 10 years, in fact, when I moved down to Florida in the South, prior to, I always like to paint the picture about like prior to Pulse, because LGBTQ people and communities of color, we're always marginalized when it comes to resources, especially when it comes to our mental health well-being and just community support. At the center here in Orlando, during the tragedy, we were a small staff of 4 employees. So imagine something as huge as a tragedy happening really kind of exacerbated what we all knew what were the issues here, especially things that impact our Latinx communities and undocumented communities. When the tragedy happened in 2016, there was a lot of immediate needs. First, it's right medical care, ensuring that the survivors are getting the medical treatment that they deserve and affirming to their identities, informing the families. We got to recognize that a lot of the families were from all over the world. We had a lot of families that were in South America that had to be notified, that didn't even know that their loved ones was present in the club to begin with. So there was a lot of notifications that were happening, but there was a lot of crisis, because when something like mass tragedies happen in communities, the first response is there's a crisis, right? And especially to a community that's been marginalized for so long, there was a lot of support and love that was shown, which sometimes it could be a little overwhelming. But really, in reality, the first couple of days, it was all about funeral arrangements, ensuring what was needed at that moment, flying families from the world, coordination with a lot of folks and on the ground those first days.
I think about, you frequented the club on a regular basis. It was a really important part of the community, and really even not just in Orlando, but for Florida. And you had friends in the nightclub that night. How important was Pulse as an institution within the LGBTQ community, you know, for not just Orlando, but really for a lot of people around the region?
Yeah, a lot of times nightclubs and bars, especially queer bars, are what we call our church, our safe haven. I used to frequent to Pulse all the time. I was actually there the Saturday before that and the previous Saturday before that, not realizing that that will be my last couple weekends at Pulse. Especially it was a Latin night, a Latinx night with, well, and a lot of times I always say this, they always put like Latin nights on the odd nights, like either on a Tuesday or Wednesday night. So finally, the intersections of being Latinx and being queer was in this Saturday night that we had. So it was a very welcoming space, a very loving space. That was one of the first clubs I actually visited when I moved down to Florida, because there's not that many spaces and now we're losing them. I had friends there that night. My best friend was actually there that night. And a lot of, like a lot of us, we didn't hear from a lot of people hours until after. And it was really heartbreaking to me because I didn't even know if my friend was even alive. And what luckily happened? He was and survived the tragedy.
He survived. Okay, good.
He survived, but I did have another individual that did lose his life who was an acquaintance of mine. But our community, sometimes we're small, right? And sometimes we're always connected. And I feel like everyone's connected by 2 degrees, right? So especially in a queer community where we kind of consider ourselves each other family, we're always connected and kind of cross paths at one time or another.
You know what? You said something interesting just now. It's like, I mean, that pulse goes away. Did you find a new space, you know, that provides that safe haven?
So our community was really resilient because we build spaces that really kind of recognize how we had to build more spaces outside of just the nightclub, right? Especially in marginalized communities, we don't have those times that we could talk to each other and talk about the social issues are impacting us. So a lot of spaces have been built outside of the nightclub. We have organizations that form like QLatinx, which are grassroots movements here in Central Florida, Bros and Convo, which intersects with the Black community and the queer community, and just a lot of programming. Divas in Dialogue, which intersects with trans Black women to uplift their voices. But we have found spaces in certain nightclubs. Some bars have opened up to kind of fill that void.
But not the same as before.
It will never be the same.
Yeah. You know, going back to what you said at the very beginning, you said this is like yesterday for us. And that's so fascinating because I'm wondering about, you still work as a case manager with the survivors of that massacre and with the families. And just wondering, how is that trauma 5 years later shape their lives? How are you able to get the support to them?
Yeah, like it's trauma like this, and people go through violence every single day. We have to recognize that, and healing is not linear. 5 years out, and I know people outside of our community, and as a person who works closely, people might think everything's like fine and dandy. You know, families and survivors receive some little bit lump sum of money in the beginning, but money doesn't really solve anything. And it's a long time of recovery. I could give an example right now where one of our cases, one of the moms, I don't want to put her name out there, but she lost her loved one in this club, and this loved one was her caregiver and always looked out for her. And now this person that looked out for her is no longer here. So this void will always live with her. And during these last 5 years, she hasn't really healed, and she forgot about herself, and she stopped medication. She is diabetic. And now recently she just came out of isolation and is working closely with us. But because of her neglect on her medication, she now has vision impairments and now needs help just getting to and from doctors.
At least it's good to hear that she's finally getting out, you know, and not just, you know, staying inside. I can't even begin to imagine. Again, I'm talking with Joel Jr. Morales, Director of Operations at the LGBTQ Center in Orlando. Saturday marks 5 years since the Pulse massacre. You can find more resources on supporting victims of Pulse. Just go to our social media, WLRN Sundial. Joel, I had to ask you, you know, Senators Marco Rubio and Rick Scott are pushing forth a resolution to honor the 49 victims of the tragedy and designate that former nightclub as a national landmark. How have advocates within the community responded to that news?
Here on the ground, honestly, we're happy about that news that is going to be memorized forever because it needs to. We need to remember what happened there. But it just doesn't end there as well. There is a lot of need that needs to be recognized, especially with the recent veto of line items from the governor's office to support the community. But as far as that goes, with the that being marked as the moment, we're really excited. We're really happy for that because it just shows support from our some of our elected officials.
And you're talking about there was a project or some money that was set aside for mental health services to the survivors of Pulse. The governor's office had vetoed it.
Correct.
Is what you're talking about. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's something that, you know, we've reported on. But I had to get to this. You know, this, I mean, this is June is Pride Month.
Yes.
This is a time for celebration, but I mean, you have this anniversary. So I'm just wondering how you balance those two.
That is a really great question because it's something that our community here struggles with, right? Because we're very prideful. We're a very welcoming city. And it's Pride Month, but we have to face two realities, right? We have to recognize and be prideful for who we are, but also take time to remember the tragedy that took place during Pride Month as well. So it's kind of like that double-edged sword of celebration, but also a remembrance. So it's like it's a roller coaster for us here, I can say, during the month of June, of high moments and then those down moments.
Yeah. And how have you and, you know, again, the survivors, you know, handled the pandemic? Because you had all this time where people couldn't even see each other or, you know, only through a screen. You're trying to help people, but you had, you know, that complication of a pandemic keeping us all shut in.
Yeah. Oh my God. I know everybody had a hard time during the pandemic and we're still living through a pandemic right now, especially with like a nonprofit like ours and providing direct services is not the same via Zoom or like video conferencing, right? Because especially communities, they need that like touch and that support and that resilience. But we were able to work through it. And I'm really thankful because our community, our local community is super strong. We were actually able to create a grassroots mutual aid foundation called the LGBTQ Relief Fund. And we were able to help 800 of our LGBTQ people receive direct cash assistance because, as we know, Florida with the unemployment system takes a long time and is a little broken there. And especially LGBTQ people who work in tourism and hospitality are really impacted by those industries in the early times of the pandemic. So we were there to step up in a way that probably our government couldn't.
You know, if people wanted to keep supporting survivors of the shooting, what's the best way for them to do it?
Yes, thank you. So you can visit us at the website at thecenterorlando.org/donate. On there, you'll find a platform where you can donate. Currently, right now, we're actually asking for a matching grant. We have family members, Wright, who had lost their child at the Pulse nightclub, and they pledged $25,000. And for every dollar that we raise, they will match that dollar. So that is also found on our website called thecenterorlando.org/OUAC match.
And we'll be able to put that also on our social media as well. You know, just to finish up, Joelle, you know, talking to the LGBTQ community throughout South Florida, what do you say to them? What's the message? You're celebrating Pride, but again, there's this dark moment tomorrow that, you know, everybody has to remember. What's the message?
Yeah, the message is just you're not alone. And no matter where you are, we're here for you and we're all connected. And although we're here in Central Florida, we have you in our hearts in Miami, and we hope that Miami has us in their hearts as well.
Joelle Jr. Morales, Director of Operations at the LGBTQ Center in Orlando. Again, tomorrow marks 5 years since the Pulse massacre. Find more resources on supporting the victims of Pulse. Just go to our social media, WLRN Sundial. Joelle, thank you so much. You know, just have a wonderful June, but, you know, for tomorrow, excuse me, Saturday, you know, for the rest of the month, though, hope you find some joy and happiness.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Thank you. And that's our program for this Thursday, June 10th. Sundial Senior Producers Chris Remington. Leslie Ovalle is our producer and social media editor. Our engagement editor is Katie Lepre. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. WLRN's interim program director and technical supervisor is Peter J. Meritz. And the theme music for the program is from the Miami Afro-Cuban funk band Palo. Go online, find them at gopalo.com. Well, coming up next week on the program, cruise ships are ready to set sail later this summer without a vaccine requirement. Companies have been preparing to get their ships ready for sail following CDC guidelines. We're going to learn what the experience will be like on a cruise ship during this new normal. Plus, we're going to have a conversation with a panel of teachers. We're going to be talking about this issue of teaching history and civics and the issue of race. It's become a very controversial topic in the state of Florida. And by the way, if you happen to teach history in any public school here in South Florida, any grade level, we'd love to hear from you. Email us, sundial@wlrnnews.org, because we'd like to hear your thoughts on how we should be teaching American history today. And don't forget, by the way, we have a Sundial Book Club. You want to know what the book we're reading? Well, please, come on, find us on Facebook. Go to Sundial Book Club, because we're going to be talking with the author next week, and we'd love your questions. Find us there again on Facebook, Sundial Book Club. Join us there. It is, we're reading Key Lime Crime, and we want to hear your thoughts. It's by Lucy Burdett. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thank you so much for listening. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute.